You're listening to 9 Plus, a research podcast from SETU Ireland. Welcome along to 9 Plus, a podcast that's about research at the South East Technological University. I'm your host, Rob O'Connor. I'm a lecturer in the Department of Computing and Mathematics, but the podcast is not tied to any one discipline. We're open to all areas. And actually, this episode relates to all areas of research: equality, diversity and inclusion, or EDI for short. I sat down in the studio with Alison Keneally, the Vice President for EDI at SETU, and Susan Flynn, the Head of Department of Arts, to talk about the issues surrounding EDI and why it's so important for university research in the 21st century. Alison and Susan both spoke about their own careers to date, with Susan giving us some details about a recent book she was involved in, Equality in the City, which is a series of academic essays that imagine smarter, more inclusive city living. As is customary on 9 Plus, we began by having the guests introduce themselves.
I'm Alison Keneally, and my current role in SETU is I am Vice President for Equality, Diversity and Inclusion here at the University.
And I'm Susan Flynn, and I'm the Head of Department of Arts here at SETU in Waterford.
Okay, so we're largely talking about EDI, Equality, Diversity and Inclusion. It's a very broad topic. It's a huge area, and it's one that is becoming, people are more aware of, I think. The fact that Alison's role exists, I don't think that role would have existed a number of years ago, would it? So Alison, when would these offices have started to be formalised?
Yeah, so look, my role is a new one in the university here. I'm in the role a little over 18 months, and it was the first VP appointment for Equality, Diversity, Inclusion. I think it's great because it signals a real commitment for the university for this area. But I suppose the topic, the wider topic of EDI, I think has been embedded in the IoT sectors and the RTC since our very beginning, even though people don't realise it. You know, we've always been very strong in providing education opportunities for those who mightn't have had them in the traditional universities. We've always been really strong in terms of access. So I think we have a long history of being very strong in some elements of EDI. And then I suppose about 5 or 6 years ago, the sector starts to look more at gender equality and Athena Swan and initiatives like that. And that really put the impetus on universities to start engaging in this work a little bit more. And since then, we see more and more topics, I suppose, becoming relevant. So things like race equality, you know, tackling sexual violence and harassment and all the other types of inequalities that we can see in society, I suppose, you know, they're reflected here as well. So it's a very wide and varied role. But I think, you know, it's great to see it now been put centre in the university.
And Susan, so you're as the head of art, but you have recently published a book, Equality in the City, kind of about imaginaries of the smart future, which again is looking at some of those issues in a kind of a wider metropolitan context. And that's kind of where we're coming from here with respect to this conversation. Would you say that's fair?
Yeah, I suppose my interest is the theory of equality studies, but that's a very interdisciplinary area. So it encompasses economics and sociology and law and, you know, a whole range of different aspects. So even though the book is called Equality in the City, it's really looking at how we live and how we plan for urban life from a whole variety of perspectives. So bringing together architects, you know, human geographers, sociologists, etc. And everything around equality and equality studies is interdisciplinary. All of the work that Alison's doing in the office is interdisciplinary. It spans all of our work in university life, in the programmes that we teach, in the way we engage with learners. It's a whole, you know, it's really wide ranging. It's not just a pigeonhole and it's not a box to be ticked. So I suppose I feel quite strongly that equality isn't a generic word, that it's an approach that we're trying to use. So we're trying to go beyond, you know, passive solutions of having policies. We're actually trying to enact a new way of engaging with the research community, engaging with students, the way that we do research.
Let's talk about maybe a practical example, okay? Because
equality in research, equality in education. Can you maybe give me an example of a major issue and then an initiative that's around that issue or to tackle that issue? And Alison or Susan, whoever wants to go with this, or maybe you both might like to answer. I'm open to either.
Okay. I suppose the best part of my work is that I learn something new every day, and that the issues, I think, you know, and the challenges in EDI work, they continuously change, I suppose, as society changes. So a couple of examples, I mean, I can pick some around maybe gender identity, because this is something that, you know, we see lots of social movements around, really energising movements with our students, you know, who are often ahead of us really when it comes to these types of issues. So, you know, we know now that many of our students who come into SETU, you know, might have non-binary gender identities or might be trans students. And that's something that we probably weren't really focusing on or very aware of maybe 10 years ago, whereas now we really are. So like things that we've done in that area, for example, would be that SETU, we're actually leading a national sexual project funded by the HEA to roll out training on gender identity for all staff. Because like, Rob, what people often say is like, I'm not really sure about the terminology or the words or pronouns. What are these pronouns that we now see on email addresses and things like that? And so a big part of this is really just to make people more comfortable, just to, you know, help people understand the terminology, which is forever changing too, you know, and trying to keep up with, to date with that. So that project we're leading is training. It's also, we've set up a national network. So we now have people from each of the partner universities who come together and just to try to share best practice in this area. And SETU also has a policy, a draft policy now that we hope we'll have approved soon. Again, just putting in place the good practice I think we already have in terms of trying to support students who want to change their gender identity, and indeed staff who want to do so too, you know. So that, I mean, that's one practical example. There are many others.
Well, I mean, I'd like to maybe just pull on that thread briefly because I mean, I've learned an awful lot about this over the last number of years. And again, I'm talking from a position of, look, I'm a white male of a certain age, so I'm grand, if you know what I mean. And when I view things through my own personal experiential lens, it's biased, and it is, and I have to accept that. That's not a bad thing. It's not saying that I'm a bad person or anyone else in that position is necessarily a bad person. It's just maybe haven't necessarily thought about things. And it was a training thing that I did a couple of years ago, or at some stage in the last while. Time has no meaning over the last couple of years. It's all a bit squished. About the pronouns on the likes of an email signature. And so, as my wife says to me, like, I'm like a mountain man, you know, kind of unkempt hair and unruly beard. So me putting he, him on an email signature is of no great... nobody's going to be surprised by that. You know, nobody's going to, I don't think there's an issue there about gender identity. But that's not really what it's about, though, is it? Alison, you're kind of nodding there. So when I put the likes of that on my email signature, it's not about me, is it?
It generally isn't. So I know that, I mean, when I started in SETU, I put my pronouns on my email signature, and lots of people were coming up to me afterwards and saying, you know, what's that about? Or I was talking to the lads in the office and they were all wondering, we were Googling afterwards what this was about. And I think that shows the power of doing something so simple, because it does, A, it starts a conversation, but B, it's also very important. Like, I was a head of department for a number of years, okay? And I suppose if you think about our learners, right, we have 18,000 students in SETU. And, you know, the research would say maybe approximately 1% and perhaps more of those students would be non-binary students. The power in them seeing, you know, those pronouns on an email signature, it really can help people who are non-binary or who use pronouns that, you know, to feel accepted, to feel that, you know, this is actually, it's okay for me to be myself here in the university. I can come forward, I can go to my head of department, I can go to the admin office and say, look, I want to change my gender identity, or I'm transitioning, or whatever it is. So for me, like, it doesn't cost me anything to put my pronouns on an email signature. And I always feel if that makes one student or one staff member in this university feel more comfortable in them being themselves, then for me, it's absolutely worth it. And I think that is the point. It is just to show, I suppose, allyship, and it is to show that we're open, and I suppose that we're inclusive. You know, people don't have to use the pronouns, there's absolutely no obligation, but like, I do know from speaking to students that it certainly it has meant a lot to students when they do see people using them. And I suppose it's symbolic of our approach and our values, I think, to this as a university.
Susan, you as a head of department now, you must encounter a number of students in this position or other positions that maybe you need to view through an EDI lens. Is there any one area that you have found, oh, do you know what, that actually has made a positive impact? Any one example? It could be pronouns, it could be anything else. Anything else, you know, something we did or something we've done or we're going to do that I think makes it a more welcoming space for people?
I don't think there's one particular thing. I think the whole sense of, you know, having the vice president for EDI, having that EDI office, sort of sets the tone for all of the teaching that goes on in the department and across the university. And I think it's a really nice sort of resource for us to have to go to if we need to look at policy, if we need to ask someone, hey, what do we do about this situation? Mm-hmm. It's great to know that Alison and her team are there and they're very vocal, you know. And so it's all about putting what we kind of know into practice rather than just thinking about policy or theory. We're actually enacting, you know, new ways of delivering. And I think the whole idea of EDI is that it's making people more open to multiculturalism. So, I mean, obviously our demographic's changing rapidly. I mean, in Ireland and in Europe, and we have this great influx of people coming to our university and coming to the region. And I think it's the perfect time for EDI to come out and be more vocal about us all expanding our ideas about what a student is, what they look like, their life experience. Mm. And I think once we can encourage all of the staff to embrace that diversity and really bring it into their teaching design, then I think it's going to result in a much better experience for all students, not just the minority students.
Yeah, I mean, I see it in my own role as a lecturer, people in the classroom, we have a much less homogenous student body now. An awful lot of African names, an awful lot of Eastern European names. Some of them have a thicker Waterford accent than I do because they've been here for their whole life. You know, they're Irish. They're, you know, But I would also be very mindful that maybe their experience is not the same as my experience, which obviously it isn't. How does Ireland fare internationally when it comes to EDI in an educational context? That's a big question, I know. Either of you?
Well, I can start on that. Yeah. So I think in some areas we fare very well. In others, we have a lot of work to do. So, for example, in terms of EDI in higher education, there's been a huge amount of work in the past, say, 6-7 years around gender equality. And that has improved quite significantly. Like, I remember back in 2017, and when the first kind of reports from the HA started coming out about gender equality, looking at them and realising, and I've worked in the sector for a while, and realising at that stage, like, there'd never been a female president of a university in Ireland in over 400 years. Like, that was shocking, you know.
Yeah.
And it was when we actually saw the data and we saw, like, actually, you know, this is where we are. You know, I think 17% of senior academics, professorships or senior posts in our universities were held by women. And it was when you actually saw the data, you realised, you know, actually, hang on here now, we have a real problem. And I think a lot of work, time, effort has been put in by everybody across the sector to tackle some of those issues. And like, we've made significant progress. And I think that's really too welcome. So I think internationally, in terms of gender equality, we've done very well. A lot of our European colleagues and counterparts would look to Ireland for best practice in that area. But then there are other areas where we're only scratching the surface. So race equality, I think, and I know Susan will speak to this as well. Like, so that's one area where, you know, I suppose we lack data, we lack information. And I think it's great that the HEA are now starting to push more development in this area. So the survey that was done last year about race equality, and the findings, you know, clearly indicated that race inequality is an issue in our universities. It's not surprising, but sometimes I think we can be in a bit of denial. We think, no, it's not, it's grand, everything's fine. But when we actually asked people, you know, they found that race inequality was an issue, not in very obvious ways, not in deliberate ways. Sometimes it can be kind of microaggressions or, you know, more subtle forms of discrimination that people encounter So I think we have a lot of work to do. Other countries like the UK, the USA have done a lot more work around race equality than we would have. But again, I think like that's starting to change. Actually, Susan there is going to chair a subgroup of our EDI committee on race equality. And Susan might talk a little bit more about that. But I think, you know, we do have to improve in that area.
Susan, would you like to come in there?
Yeah, so we're looking for people to come and join our Race Equality Forum, which is, as Alison said, I suppose a subcommittee, but we really just want to engage with learners and staff who are interested in representing their life experience if it's different to ours. We don't want, you know, we don't want this committee to be about us. It's about the students and the learners and the staff who are affected by race inequality, really. But, you know, it's we're making progress. We have our first President's Scholarship PhD student who's just began, Sandra Nolan, examining race and EDI. So we're really positive that we can really enact some meaningful changes and grow our body of research around EDI. At the moment, I'm actually rolling out a module on structured PhD, which is called EDI for Transformative Research. And all of those researchers enrolled in that are really doing fantastic work across the whole spectrum in the humanities. So we're really optimistic for the future that we're going to make some big changes. Mm. So it's great. So there's a lot of work ongoing. And again, anyone interested in joining our committees, please like get in touch. We'd be happy to hear from anyone.
In my own area in computing, has a significant gender imbalance, and it's been like that for a number of times, heavily in favour of males. There's no good reason for this. It just seems to be something that has arisen. And I'm actually involved in a group called Ingenic, which is the Irish Network for Gender Equality in Computing. And I'm one of the representatives from SETU, as is Ciara Barrett from Carlow. And what's kind of interesting about it is that I'm one of the token males on the group, which is actually why, one of the reasons why I'm there. But I've found it a very eye-opening experience. And I'll give you a kind of really small example of maybe the kind of microaggression that Alison was referring to. I'd walk into a class and we might have, you know, let's say 25 students in a lab, and you know there could be three females in there. But I go in, well, lads, da da da, and I now know that kind of language can be a turn off. You know, even though in a Waterford context, lads is everyone. But anyway, you know, I know that it can be a turn off, and I know that it's not that I would like to think of myself as not being sexist, but it's just unaware. So using kind of gender neutral terms like "well, folks" is seems to be a better way, a more welcoming way. Does that make sense, Alison? You're kind of nodding at me, so please tell me I'm being a good lad.
Yeah, no, that does make sense. And the fact that like we're even having this conversation, and the fact that you're aware, that shows how far we've come over a short period of time, I think. Yeah. You know, and when we talk, like there are discipline areas where there are, you know, significant gender skews, and that can be either way. So, you know, we see male students reluctant to kind of go into the more caring or education professions. Sometimes, you know, female students then maybe less likely to go into the STEM areas and computing. And like a lot of that is it's gendered from a very young age. Like we were talking earlier, and I have a 3-year-old, we were looking at the Smith's toy catalogue last night, right? Because, you know, Christmas is approaching and all the rest. We're talking about what Santa might like to bring. And every time I opened a page with like anything pink or dolls, he's like, no, ma'am, go to the boys' pages. And he's 3. And I'm meant to be working in EDI. So I'm going like, you know, what's going on here? So I think there's just such societal stereotyping going on from an incredibly young age that, you know, unfortunately, it's still not the norm that, you know, women will maybe necessarily go into the STEM areas. Like, it has improved hugely. There's so much great work. I'm really familiar with the Ingenic group, you know, and we see, you know, when initiatives like Athena Swan, for example, when they get embedded into the departments, they can have really powerful change. Like, we're not going to change society overnight. We're not suddenly going to have 50% female and male students. But I think just being aware of things that can turn students off, like, yeah, language, subtle things like that, not deliberate, but that can make a big difference. And we also, when we talk to female students, they say, well, I don't want to be the only girl in the class. Yeah. You know, I want other females, other girls to be there around me. And it can even be something as simple as changing the title of a program. Mm. So if engineering is kind of bioengineering, all of a sudden you're more likely to get more female students into it. So like, there, we don't have to reinvent the wheel. There's really good practice as well from other countries and other jurisdictions in terms of what they've done to try to encourage more people in. But, you know, like EDI, it is the work is reflective of society in general. And I think we have a long way to go with the gender stereotyping. Like it's still an issue.
I want to talk to you about kind of EDI requirements on research and research funding. And we'll get to that in a moment. But I just kind of want to pull on something maybe first that you mentioned, Alison, about the lack of females in senior academic roles. And I did an interview with Veronica Campbell, president of SETU there previously on 9+. And she said, you know, again, that like back in 2017, there had been no president of a university in Ireland that was female, which I was really surprised at. Whereas now, look, we're talking to two women in senior academic roles here at SETU. Can I just delve into your own professional backgrounds and just maybe find out a little bit about where you're coming from and kind of how you have ended up in the role that you are in now? So, sure, Susan, we'll start with yourself. So, Susan, let's go back maybe to kind of you going to college in the first place. What did you study? Where did you study? How did you choose that?
I began in UCC with a BA in English and Sociology, and I actually went off to work and I taught in what was then the VECs, which are now ETBs, and I taught a range of learners from traveller women to learners with disabilities, physical and mental. I worked in youth reaches in the inner city in Sheriff Street. So,
Did you always want to be in education? Was that always something that was in the back of your mind?
Not really. I suppose I loved English, and I discovered through teaching that I really loved people, and I really learned to teach from those learners and I learned how to relate to people. So later, after having children, I did a master's in film studies and went back to work and found that I couldn't work because I realised that I knew so little after the master's. So I started my PhD in equality studies while pregnant with my fifth child, and a new CD in the Centre for Equality Studies. And I went to work there then, worked, studied, learned, and it changed my life. And equality studies has become my life. It's my life's work. And everything that I study and research and write is about equality and how we can bring it into people's lives, how it can be the way we live. It's a religion to me.
I'm flabbergasted that you started a PhD whilst pregnant on your fifth child. So I'm not trying to... I'm blown away because I don't know how you found the time for it. Surely that informs the position that you're in now. As a working mother, working parent. That must impact the way that you view these things. In a positive way, I mean.
I suppose anyone who's a parent knows that your children will teach you more than anyone or anything else. And I'm really lucky. I have five children and two stepchildren. And I think together we all teach each other quite a lot. It does inform the way I live my life. I'm always trying to think about how we can make things better for those who come behind, rather than just make things cushy for ourselves. I do try to help and champion other, you know, working parents because I know how difficult it is. But I'm also very cautious that those people who don't have family commitments are also, as you know, obliged to or should be obliged as much. You know, I don't want to sort of give preferential treatment to parents because we all have commitments and needs. But I am aware of how tough it can be, obviously.
Yeah. So I'm not trying to create a division or to create a kind of a one person versus another person or anything like that. But the lived experience, either whether staff member or student, it doesn't matter really, of somebody who's a parent and maybe has those kind of commitments and those burdens. Burdens is the wrong word, but you know what I mean. That look, you might have to collect somebody from school, or you might have to drop somebody off at the creche, or maybe you can't afford a creche, or whatever that might be. And that's true whether somebody's a student or staff. Even when I remember 100,000 years ago when I was a student, there was a campaign for single mothers looking for childcare facilities for undergraduate students. I don't know if anything ever came of it, to be honest with you, because at the time I would have been completely blissfully unaware. The only reason I even knew it was going on was because there was a girl in my class who was heavily involved in the campaign because she had a child. I don't really have a point, but but I don't really have a point, but this is a conversation. So,
but I think, you know, it's important to remember we're really privileged being employed in this sector and we're relatively well paid compared to academics in other countries. So I think, you know, we're sheltered a lot from the realities that students with family responsibilities have. Maybe we forget a little bit what it's like to not be able to actually afford help when we need it. So I think it's important to bear that in mind too. We are really privileged to be in these roles and we're lucky. Not everyone is so lucky.
But also, by the same token, you've clearly worked hard for it. You know, you don't do a PhD when you're pregnant for the crack. You know, I don't think that would be.
Well, I think the best the best incentive is to really love what you do, and I have always loved the interdisciplinarity of equality studies. Like, it's a huge field. People don't know that there is actually this disciplinary field, that there is a huge body of research, and Ireland is actually almost a global leader because we have some incredible academics in Ireland working in equality. So Alison and I are both really keen to harness that, you know.
Well, then the same question to you, Alison. Could you maybe take us through your own kind of professional journey? So how do you, okay, so you're now the VP for EDI here at SETU. That's a lot of acronyms there, by the way.
It's okay.
I didn't mean to do that. But how do you get to there? I mean, where does Alison Keneally leaving school, how do you end up where you are today?
Oh, well, there's no grand plan. That's the first thing I'd say. So, you know, I was one of these probably annoying people who always knew what I wanted to study. Not what I wanted to do, but what I wanted to study. I think it's come back to what Susan was saying. It's about doing what you love. So I always knew I wanted to study law. Law was for me, right? That was it. I remember as a young girl seeing Mary Robinson at the time, having her inauguration as the first female president of Ireland, and just been so inspired by her. And I was always really interested in law because of the power it had to create societal change. So that makes sense, and kind of where it intersected with that societal change and social justice. So I always knew I wanted to do law. So off I went to UCD, did my undergrad, I did a master's as well. So I did my law degree, and I did a master's in commercial law, actually. I'm not quite sure now why, but I did. So had the degree and master's, and then I was one of these people. I was going to go to Australia. I was going to maybe where I didn't know what I wanted to do. And a lecturing role in the Institute of Technology, Carlow, actually came up at the time, as it was then. So I started work in a legal practice. Wasn't loving it. A lot of bit paperwork and admin-y for me. So I decided I'd go for this AL role. And I wasn't top of the panel, but it got knocked down to me eventually. So I was delighted, took up the role, and I absolutely loved it. Like, I loved my job. I was lucky to work with fantastic colleagues and students in a lecturing role. And I was in that job for maybe 7 or 8 years. And the head of department role became available. Head of department that I was working with left. And I applied for that job and got that at the time. So again, I was in that role for a number of years and I loved it. And I also worked for 2 years in the Wexford campus as campus coordinator. So I loved working with people. So the more people I could kind of meet and work with, the better. And so I was kind of happy enough going along doing that. And then I remember seeing things around, you know, obviously Athena Swan and gender equality, and like I had a huge interest in that area. So then it was about 6-7 years ago when work in this area started to kind of ramp up a bit, that I was seconded from my head of department position and asked to work on this initiative, which I did in Carlow at the time. And we applied and got an Athena Swan Institutional Bronze Award, which was the first of its kind in the sector. So that's how I ended up in EDI work, and I just loved it, and here I am. I've stayed there ever since, and then was lucky enough to move down to Waterford a couple of years ago, and ended up in the VP role. So look, it's you can never plan these things. It doesn't suddenly, life works like that, but I think if you're doing something that you love, it's easy to do it.
I don't think I've ever spoken to anyone who had a plan and everything went to it, you know. But that's the adventure, isn't it? Susan, can I ask you quickly about the book Equality in the City? So Imaginaries of the Smart Future. So that was published in January of this year, January of 2022. So it's edited by you, but it's a collection of pieces and essays from a variety of different people. Could you maybe talk about what the major themes of the book are? And we're going to try and dovetail this into the larger conversation about EDI as well.
Yeah, I suppose that the major theme is, I suppose, how can we really enact a meaningful democracy? Because I suppose the rhetoric or the narrative around smart cities is that they'll be able to deliver more efficient services, transport, energy system and so on. But in that narrative, I suppose the individual person's story is lost. So I suppose, as the great Shannon Matron would say, the city isn't a computer and people aren't computers. We're not machine readable. So using our data to feed into this grand algorithm, something's lost, something innately human about our stories and our differences. It's very much lost. So I suppose the ethos of the book is, how can we enact a more real democracy where people and their humanness and their stories can come in and be part of the plan for the future city? And actually contributing to that book, our Vice President for Strategy, Richard Hayes, has a brilliant essay, and also Owen O'Shea, who's in our Department of Architecture. So there's very much an SETU bias in the book. And actually Richard and I are editing a follow-on book to come out next year, which looks at Waterford as a case study of how we can plan for the city of the future. So that's very exciting.
You've done a number of books now at this stage, haven't you? How many?
Yeah, I'm working on the 9th and 10th book at the moment. So 2 came out this year, hopefully 2 next year.
And am I right in saying that the Equality in the City book is available as an open access book?
Yeah, that's an open access book through Knowledge Unlatched, which is a great platform. I think the open access, where possible, is great, because the whole idea is to share this knowledge and try and encourage other people to get involved, you know, in similar research too.
So when you say open access, that means that somebody can get an electronic copy of the book.
Yeah, you can download it for free.
Yeah. Because there's a research area that I'm looking at, and I found a really interesting book that was published this year in June of 2022. I thought, deadly, this looks great. I'll buy it. And it's €200. And as you said, we are, look, we're reasonably well paid, but I don't have €200 to drop on a book, and I don't have a research budget. I was going, wow. So, but I don't see who that serves, because let's say it's a very niche audience who might read this book. So I don't really know who is served by having such a huge price tag put on access to knowledge, essentially.
Yeah, and it's kind of contrary to everything that we're trying to do with EDI, because really, you know, knowledge is power and we need to share that knowledge. So the other, I suppose, problem is the sort of knowledge that's out there being published quite often. You know, it's legitimating a certain type of power, because the people like who are educated are already privileged. So it's about democratizing knowledge and democratizing access, you know.
Speaking of which, Alison, I want to talk to you then about maybe some kind of utilitarian aspects around EDI. So I know that many European funding calls, so a lot of research is funded through the European Commission, and a lot of proposals must meet specific guidelines around EDI. I know there's the Commission Gender Equality Strategy, there's an EU Anti-Racism Strategy, and am I right in saying that with Horizon Europe, all institutions or organisations who want to apply for funding must have a gender equality plan in place? Is that correct?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it's a very welcome requirement now from Horizon Europe. The European Commission have led a lot of work on gender equality. I've referenced, you know, their gender equality strategy. So it is a requirement that all applicants, all partners, anyone involved in any application now for Horizon Europe funding must have a gender equality action plan in place. And not only do you have to have a plan, but you have to meet certain requirements and certain recommendations then that they have in terms of what's in that plan, how it's prepared, how it's implemented and so on, which I think is really welcome. You know, because as I said, okay, in Ireland, most of the universities probably had these plans already, but certainly across Europe, it wasn't as commonplace. So I think it's a very strong signal from the Commission that they take this very seriously. So that's definitely in its requirement. And as you alluded to as well, you know, in terms of the funding applications, they now expect consideration of the gender dimension. And indeed, I think the Commission have moved from a focus on gender equality in terms of, you know, a very kind of a simple view to a much more intersectional view. So they've started to look at inclusive gender equality.
Yeah.
Okay. Which is, and there's an important difference. I think as well, the work in gender equality has moved from gender equality to inclusive gender equality. So it's not just looking at a kind of a male-female data or divide. It's taken a much wider approach to that. So, for example, if we're looking at, you know, data by gender, and we look at the percentage of women. Okay, we talked earlier on about the percentage of women who were in senior academic posts in Ireland. But if we then look to say, well, what are the percentage of ethnic minority women in these posts in Ireland? Well, there are none as far as I know. You know, so when you actually break down, or what are the percentage of women with disabilities or from the travelling community and so on. So the EU are taking a much more intersectional approach, an inclusive approach to their gender equality work, which is really good. So they expect people applying for research grants, research funding to include data on that, in, you know, and on their approach to the research from a gender perspective. And they also expect to see, you know, gender balance, for example. I mean, it's very basic stuff now, gender balance in the teams that are applying, in terms of PIs, in terms of the team members and so on like that. And I mean, that's not only a European requirement now, but we know it's, you know, there are requirements in SFI, the Health Research Board, IRC. You know, these requirements now are well and truly embedded in the research landscape, which, again, I think is really welcome. It shows they're taking this very seriously. I mean, it's not something that's going to go away. They're not going to ramp down. They're going to ramp up, you know, what they expect and what they require. So I think it's up to us as a university to, and I suppose, and to me in my office and in the research office, I know they do lots of fantastic work on this. Susan is delivering a module on this to our research, some of our research students. So I think it's up to us to rise to the challenge now, and to show, you know, how we are really doing this in a real way, you know, in a real way in our university. Because sometimes I have a bugbear now about this, but sometimes like EDI work can be seen as kind of like almost performative. You know, we have a day about something and then that's it, you know, or we have an event and then like, but to me, it's about like what's behind that event. It has to be credible. Like it has to be real what we're doing. It has to have an impact. You know, and otherwise, you know, kind of what's the point? So I think it's great that all these requirements are now there, and it does put the onus on us to now rise up and meet them. And like when I talk to people across the university, people want to do this, you know, like people are really up for the challenge, which I think is great to see.
So if I put a cynical hat on for a moment, right, I could say this is all just tokenism. But what you're saying is that, no, there's real impacts of this. And could you give me an example of, look, this is a real impact and this was a positive impact, so that you can knock that cynical hat off my head?
Yeah, I can. Like, I'll give you one example of some work we're doing at the moment, which is we've piloted and we're rolling out a programme in the EDI office on tackling sexual violence and harassment, right? And we know this is an issue across universities in Ireland. It's something that our students, unfortunately, can encounter, and staff indeed too. So we've decided, a lot of the focus was on students, okay? So, you know, consent training and programmes for students coming in. And we felt there was a gap in relation to staff. Okay, we weren't giving staff the same opportunity to engage in training and to learn. So we piloted and rolled out a programme in the office, in the EDI office, with Roisin and Anne, who I'm lucky to work with. So a shout out to them. They've done great work on this. But we get feedback from all the participants because we want to know what is actually the impact of the programme. And, you know, the amount of people that have come, people fill out the forms and we analyse the data and all of that. And we can see that there is, people really want the training. You know, people are actually reconsidering, I suppose they're examining their own attitudes, their own beliefs. Like even we have discussions about things like, you know, victim blaming, about the kind of, you know, the everyday, sometimes sexist attitudes and beliefs that people can have without actually even realising them, or realising that they're impactful on other people. So we've seen like a huge, usually positive feedback from staff on that programme. We're actually rolling it out now so that all new staff coming into SETU will do the training as part of their induction. And like, we just had a training session during the week and it was lovely to get some, you know, we don't always get always positive feedback. So it's lovely to get it from one staff member who just said like he was delighted to see that SETU were prioritising this as part of induction and part of orientation for new staff. And that sends a clear message from the start that, you know, we want to create a culture where that kind of behaviour is absolutely not acceptable and that we do take a zero tolerance approach. So I think if people see you trying to, you know, it can be difficult, it can be slow to create real culture change. But I think when people see that you're trying to do it in a real way, and hopefully people see that, then I think, you know, people are willing. I think people are open and they want to learn and they want to do the right thing. And I think if you can meet people where they're at and try to bring them with you, then, you know, you will have an impact. And in EDI, like, the impact is through our people.
Yeah.
You know, that's really where we have impact. I mean, like, we can look at our, okay, we now have a female president, you know, the first president of SETU. We have gender balance on our executive team, on governing body. We can look at all those kind of metrics. But for me, the real power is actually in the culture. You can only embed EDI into the university with the people in the university, the staff and students buying into it too, yeah, and working with you. So for me, it's trying to make an impact with people across the university. That's really where I would focus my time and efforts.
Yeah. And right, so Susan, with that in mind, and let's just go back to the book, the Equality in the City book, can you kind of dovetail maybe some of the themes from the book to what Alison has just said there? Are they pulling in the one direction?
Yeah, so I suppose, to think about that great line from George Orwell, everyone is equal, but some people are more equal than others. we have to really think about power, yeah, structures. Because it's the institutions where inequalities are embedded, you know, and this is part of what I teach in the structure PhD module. We have to really look at how power is sustained in the country and what's legitimated as knowledge. So I suppose it all adds into this sort of discussion and making this discussion open to everyone, you know, who's in power, what voices are heard, what kind of knowledge are we privileging? And it's really about taking everybody's experiences into account, the whole variety of lived experiences, because there are many outside of our own that we don't know about. And we can all learn from that. So I suppose that's how it dovetails.
A man of a certain age, okay, and like what I've learned, I mean, it's fairly obvious, but I can understand how some people may feel differently, that pro-equality, so say pro-gender equality, doesn't necessarily mean anti-male. Do you know what I mean? It's not, well, I it certainly seems to me, just because I think it makes a better environment for everyone. And I know that sounds like a kind of a platitude. It's not meant to be. But say through my work in Ingenic, I mean, I can tell you that when you have a whole load of fellas in a class, it's very homogenous. It's not great. And the atmosphere can be negative. Whereas when there's more of a balance, it changes the conversation and it does change the dynamic in the class. So that's just like at a really small level. So it's not a zero sum game. To be pro one thing does not mean you have to be anti the other. I think that's maybe an important takeaway from this. Certainly, it's been an important takeaway for me anyway. Does that make sense? Am I being too simplistic?
No, I think that's a great point, because sometimes kind of people might feel, you know, gender equality work is kind of for women, or it's only about women, and it's not. And I think it's really important, like, there's so many, like, if we look at initiatives, for example, around, you know, trying to create more family-friendly work environments, okay, yeah, that benefits everybody, you know, because, I mean, men as well as women are parents, you know, men as well as women can have care and responsibilities outside of their own children. They might have older parents, that whatever it is, you know, like, we're not one-dimensional creatures. And I think what benefits one kind of part of our staff or student population can absolutely benefit the other. Like, it is about trying to create a better place to work. And for me, like, so much of it is about just having respect for each other. And I suppose, you know, ensuring that, and just trying to stop and think, you know, are we trying to treat people in the same way? Are we listening to people's opinions equally? Are we giving them equal weight? Are we kind of standing back and looking for our own biases and prejudices that we all have? You made the point earlier, we all have them. Mm. And I think knowing you have them is the really important part. And then trying to look at things through that lens to make sure that you're countering those wherever possible in your work, you know.
I have one last question for you and then I'll let you go. It's the same question I've asked everyone who's appeared in this podcast is, imagine somebody was listening to this, they were thinking about getting into research, thinking about taking on a postgrad, thinking about something. If you could give one bit of advice to somebody who's thinking about getting into research, what would that be? Susan, we start with yourself.
Oh, my piece of advice would be that it's never too late. Yeah, it's never too late to start a degree program, to start any course of study to start any research project. And my other piece of advice, if I may, is that really you should be in the Department of Arts doing it, because we're actually the best department in the university. We're actually world class. You laugh, but it's true.
I'm
we have a world class staff of, you know, internationally renowned people delivering incredible content. And just as an example, because I really wanted to mention this in terms of diversity, the English and Drama team are working with the Dublin Theatre for the Deaf, as you may know, as part of the Lyrical Bodies research project. You know, there's all kinds of experiences in the world, and the Department of Arts is uniquely placed really to represent those and to give voice to some of this, you know, amazing different lived experiences. So I would just say, yes, come to us, we're the best.
I wasn't laughing at the idea of the Department of Arts being the best. I was laughing at the self-promotion.
It really is amazing.
Alison, same question to yourself. Would you have a bit of advice for maybe somebody who was thinking about embarking on a research career?
Yeah, I would. I look at myself. I've tried to go back to when I started my own doctorate. And I think, you know, I think what people need to understand is that they're well capable of doing it. Because I know what holds a lot of people back sometimes is thinking, oh, I don't know, will it be good enough? Will my work be good enough? Will I be able to actually do it and complete it? And every student, I think, everybody I've spoken to who's actually done their PhD has started out, I think, in that basis. A lot of times people don't talk about it, they kind of just, you know. But I think for people who are considering doing research, but if they're wondering, you know, will it be okay? Will it be good enough? I think you will. You know, I think if you, and I say go for it and just do it on something that you really enjoy and that you love if you can at all. And I think, you know, it's a huge privilege, isn't it, to be able to do research, to be able to work on something that you love and to like take that time out of your life to focus on one particular area. So I say to people, if they're interested at all, you know, I say go for it. Life's short. You only get one chance sometimes. So I would say, yeah, absolutely. Throw yourself in the deep end and you'll get great support as well. People are like your colleagues or other students are brilliant. That would be my experience. People will hold your hand when your hand needs holding and encourage you when you need it. And yeah, I think we've a nice environment here in the university. So I'd encourage people, yeah, go for it.
Brilliant. That's a lovely note to end on. To Alison Keneally and to Susan Flynn, thank you so much for your time today. Thanks for speaking with me on the 9 Plus podcast. If somebody wants to find out more about you or the work that you do, I know you have profiles up on the SETU website. You can find you there. And we were talking about social media earlier and the tyranny of it. We had a cup of coffee beforehand. So you can find everyone there. Folks, thank you so much.
Thanks, Rob.
Thanks, Rob.
Thanks for listening to this episode of 9 Plus. If you want to keep up to date on future episodes, you can follow us on Twitter at 9 Plus Podcast, or you can look for details on setu.ie. This will be the final episode for 2022, but we'll be back early in 2023 with more conversations about research from all the campuses at SETU. I hope you have a nice break over Christmas, and we'll talk to you again in the new year.